blood at your hand. So to be a watchman entails a tremendous responsibility. Secondly, the appointment as watchman to Israel is a further reflection of God's love. They had done enough with the sin of syncretism, which we'll come to later, to warrant the wrath of God. They have the oracles of God handed down through Moses. But still he appoints a watchman to give further words of warning before that wrath can be poured out. It's a reflection of the love of God. And thirdly, the true prophet of God will share severe words of warning of the wrath of God with a heart of compassion and love. I've heard of men who thought they had a prophetic, men and women who thought they had a prophetic word from God. They go to somebody and lash them with their tongue and leave them standing in tears. That's not a true servant of God to speak that way. It will come with an underlying compassion and love of God. Verses 18 through 21 is very sobering for us. I just mentioned earlier, because we do not want to have anyone's blood required at our hands. So read that especially carefully later on. Say, Lord, help me. I'm responsible for my family, my colleagues. And you don't have to feel like you've got to scream it at them. Live it to them. And then their blood shall not be required at our hands. Somebody said just the other day, if we are really living the life of Jesus, people will come running to us. But we are responsible to live that, to be that light. Verse 20 is an interesting phrase where God says, if you don't warn somebody, then I will lay a stumbling block, and then if he dies, he will go to hell, but I will require his blood at your hand. That phrase, I will lay a stumbling block, being spoken by God, has been a stumbling block to some believers. So let's look at that phrase quickly. I would challenge us to compare and contrast verse 20 of chapter 3 of Ezekiel with James 1:13, where that clearly shows us that God tempts no man, but rather man is tempted and led away by his own lust. However, what we do understand is that God will allow us to reap the consequences of the sin that we persist in. He's not going to stand in between there if we don't repent and ask his forgiveness. Verses 22 through 27, here's a total period of silence. Ezekiel is told by God to go to the plain. In Hebrew, it literally means valley. It very well could be the same valley of dry bones, but he deals with that more in detail in chapter 37. So he's told to go to the plain of the valley, and here all over again he sees a vision of the glory of the God of Israel, and he is told this time to be housebound and dumb, silent. See, when God tells his prophet not to speak, he must be quiet. But when God opens his mouth, he can't restrain himself. Like Jeremiah said, it's like a fire in my bones. Verse 27, the Lord through Ezekiel uses an interesting phrase, he that will hear, let him hear. That's just like what Jesus said in the New Testament, he that hath an ear to hear, let him hear. And even in Revelation to the churches, he that hath an ear to hear, let him hear. Really, hearing is no big deal. Every one of you are hearing me, but you may not be listening to me. Did you hear that? Now I want you to listen to that. Everyone, if you are hearing me, whether you want to or not, but you may or may not be listening to me. And then when you listen to me, or to what the Lord wants to say, then you need to apply it and obey it. So he that will hear, let him hear, listen and obey. Chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. Here's the symbol of Jerusalem under attack. Ezekiel is now made into a model builder and a map maker. God tells him, take a brick, which really was a tile, and it was more like 13 or 12 inches long by 4 inches wide. So for large enough for him to draw an outline sketch of Israel, of Jerusalem, with the city walls. And when that hardens, he was to lay it on the ground and make little models of implements of siege, a siege mound, a battering ram, towers, and around this earthen brick or tile, which had the map of Jerusalem, he placed these little models around it, and then he was to go perhaps to his kitchen and get a large iron plate, like a kitchen griddle, and in proportion it was much bigger than the model he would have made, and placed that. So here was the, on the one hand was the the brick or the tile. Around it were these instruments of siege, and here was this big plate, and he was the other side. So the iron plate was between the prophet Ezekiel and the model, so that he could not see it. It separated him from the model. What did this all mean? Now he was to do this right outside his house in public for everybody, the bystanders and passers-by, to see. What did this mean? It meant that Jerusalem was going to be attacked, and the Lord was going to look on. Ezekiel was on the other side of the plate, and he was going to lie facing it on one side with one arm bared as if in action and in combat and threat against it, but he could not see Jerusalem, so he was pointing at the iron griddle between him and the models. It meant that Jerusalem and Israel was going to be attacked, was going to be besieged, and that the Lord was going to look on like the prophet was gazing on, but that the Lord was not going to do anything, just like the plate was between the prophet and the models, that God was not going to stop the devastation that was going to come upon Jerusalem when she was going to be besieged and attacked. What did this mean for the exiles? Picture yourself as one of those exiles. Already you're taken away and you're in a strange land. A hostage, exile, call them what you may. And you're yearning to go back to Jerusalem. And in that state of exile, God through the prophet is saying, Jerusalem's not done for yet. She's coming in for greater tragedy. And here you are in despair, and you go into deeper dejection. Whatever hope they are clinging onto is further dashed to the ground. What hopes of returning to Jerusalem? It shows the exiles, though, that God is calling them not get this thought, not to look to Jerusalem, but to look to Him. Get your eyes off a city. Get your eyes off a place, off a location. Get them on God. Wherever you are, I am there. To these exiles, it was a message of both darkness and light, despair and hope. And I have in your sheets that every message of doom contains in it a kernel of hope. Search for it. God was saying, don't look at Jerusalem. Look for me. Verses 4 through 8. For 390 days, Ezekiel was to lie on his left side with his arm bared, pointing towards his iron griddle to the model. And then he was to turn on his right side and do the same for another 40 days. That is a total of 430 days. Folks, that was a total of more than 14 months that Ezekiel was to play out this prophetic, dramatic action before the people. A little more than 14 months. Now, each day stood for 1 year of God's judgment upon Israel in Jerusalem. Here's an interesting part. That 430 years, 390 plus 40, is the exact number of years that the children of Israel were in bondage in the land of Egypt. And I say, what terrible prophecies, but still there's hope. What happened after the 430 years of bondage in Egypt? There was the Exodus. So if you look deeper underneath, after this 430 years, there could be a second Exodus for the children of Israel. Verses 9 through 17, the prophet's diet, he was asked, eat bread. The Hebrew word really means food, but it was of a mixed variety of grains. The best way to explain it was he was to make something like a bits and pieces bun. And that was to be only about 8 ounces of it per day, with a little more than half a pint of water. And that bread was to be baked on human excrement. Instantly the prophet says, Lord, he protests. I can't do that, because he knows from his priestly upbringing it would defile him according to the Levitical rites. But God in his mercy grants Ezekiel a concession and allows him to have it baked on cow dung. By the way, cow dung is an excellent fuel. In Asia, they have gobar gas plants where it's a solid airtight container. You just take the cow dung and put it in there. It's sealed airtight. It automatically biodegradably decomposes, giving off methane gas. They have the ducts, and you have your gas burners in your house free from cow dung decomposing. Gobar gas plants. So just a thought that cow dung is an excellent fuel. So he is given a concession. Okay, you may bake the bread over cow dung. Now this diet of the prophet symbolizes the shortage of food that would hit Israel and the exiles. when they would be overtaken by the enemy, by the Babylonians, the shortage of food and water under the siege and exile. By the way, that bread I mentioned, the bits and pieces bread, it was not some oriental gastronomic delight, but it was more a recipe for leftovers. When you're under siege, whatever you can grab, here's what you live on, a recipe for leftovers. And the thought is that those who ignore the bread of the Word of God will now lack bread for their body. Chapter 5, verses 1 through 4. Israel is called in chapter 5 the center of the nations. By the way, if you have a quick look at the map behind me, if you can spot Israel in the Middle East, it's almost really in the center of the entire world. Just a few other quick free thoughts. On the Western Hemisphere, we write from the left to right in English. The Arabic nations write from the right to left. Everything centers towards Jerusalem. And if you take Jerusalem, there's Australia, southeastern, there's New Zealand, farther south, the corner point of New Zealand has a post there which says uttermost part of the earth. It is the farthermost geographical land point from the city of Jerusalem. Okay, Jerusalem here is called the center of the world, center of the earth, of the nations. Now the listeners to Ezekiel the prophet, when he was demonstrating all this with a model, etc., they could have thought to this point that the city that the prophet of God was pointing the wrath of God upon was Babylon. That is the mother of harlots. That's the nation that oppressed them. They could have been hoping that that was Babylon. But listen to what happens in verse 5. He says, as he's pointing, this is Jerusalem. Now again, put yourself in the exile shoes. All the kernel or remnant of hope they have is being dashed to the ground. You mean that's our city, the one we long and yearn to go back to? And the prophet says, this is Jerusalem. And also, praise God. Did I skip something? I said chapter 5, 1 through 4. I'm sorry. Let me take you back to chapter 5, 1 through 4. God tells Ezekiel, take a sharp sword, and this is quite a strange, it's not an experiment, it's something he's told to do. Take a sharp sword, and focus, not a razor, it's a sword, and shear off the hair of your head in public view and your beard. Now you picture the old time prophet. When you think of John the Baptist even, what do you think? Long hair, this flowing beard, and with a sword, no matter how sharp, you're not going to get a close shave with a sword as you would with a razor. In public view, he has to shave off his hair, shave off his beard, and collect it. And then he has to do something even more strange. He is to collect the hair and weigh it. I mean, people must have been laughing at him. Try weighing hair. And then he has to separate them into three equal piles. The first pile he has to cast in the fire. Second pile he has to chop up with the same sword. And the third pile he has to toss into the wind. And now what's them laughing at him while he's doing this? Toss it in the wind and take the same sword and go on and flailing after the hairs in the wind. And then when it falls down, he has to crawl on his hands and knees. Now picture him, he's totally bald and clean shaven all of a sudden in their sight. They're already laughing at him. Goes on his hands and knees groveling, collects some of the hair, puts them in a pouch, comes back here and puts some of that in the fire. Can you believe every single part of this makes perfect sense when you look for the meaning? I don't need my notes because I understand it now. The one third that was to be thrown in the fire symbolizes the one third of the population who will be killed when the enemy attack, who will be killed by the siege on the enemy when they destroy Jerusalem. The one third that will be chopped up with a sword are the one third that will be killed in battle trying to defend their city. And the one-third that's tossed into the air, which he goes flailing after, they're the one-third who are going to be escaping from the city for their lives. But he goes flailing after them. While they're escaping, some of them will still be slain, and he gets the rest of it, collects it, puts some of it in the fire. So they will go to exile, and there again, because of oppression, some of them will die. So how much does that leave that will actually survive? Very, very few. But some will survive because God always has a remnant. Now we say, yes, that makes so much sense. So hopefully we won't give up on the book of Ezekiel as we keep looking at it closely. And now, I went ahead of myself, it says, Ezekiel points to it and says, this
is Jerusalem.
And when he says that, the people are still looking at him. And look at him in such a sorry state. I feel not with that sword, having sheared his hair and beard, been clean shaven, being that it was a sword, he had to do it very delicately, there would have still have been raw skin in certain spots. And he's also saying, look at me. This is Jerusalem. Do I look a sorry sight? You bet I do. This is Jerusalem. What she's going to come to. Instead of being a light to the nations, by syncretism, Jerusalem has become darkness and an abhorrence to God, defiled and detestable. The Word of God says, to whom much is given, much is required. God help us to be clear, pure, shining lights. And here in verse 8, we read some horrifying words from God in chapter 5, verse 8. He says, I, even I, as Ezekiel points to this and says, this is Jerusalem. God says, I, even I am against you. And in verse 11, the Lord says, I will have no pity. For we must take our faith very seriously. We cannot assume our faith in Jesus Christ very lightly and discard it as we feel. To whom much is given, much is required. I trust that causes us to walk out of here with a sense of awe of the responsibility we have as the people of God. To whom much is given, much is required. In light of the prophet, when challenging the prophets of Baal, speaks to the children of Israel, and then he says, now how long will you halt between two opinions? If God is God, serve him, and if Baal is God, then serve him. So let's be zealous for God, let's be on fire for God, let's make sure we live those pure, clear Christian lives. Verses 13 through 17 of chapter 5, Israel is also called unto the nations. Israel was called to be a light to the nations. In Exodus 19:6, they are called a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. But they failed to do what they were brought into existence for, to be a light to the nations. Now listen to this thought. You have this in your sheets. If Israel would not be a light to the nations, she would be a reproach to the nations. Now put you and me in there. If we will not be a light for Jesus Christ, we could become a reproach to his name. Notice, I love this thought, the message of God will go out. It cannot be stopped. It will either go out to a righteous and a prosperous nation, or it will go out through one that is in ruins and shambles. If Israel was righteous and prospering, the world took note and said that their God must be God. But when Israel is so dramatically reduced, they will say, look at their state, they have forsaken their God. Either way, the message of God is going to go out. We need to choose which path we want to walk and follow. And the second thought about that is, by Israel's sin, the sad thought, by Israel's sin, not only did Israel lose out as a nation, but so also did the nations around. She was called to be a light to the nation. By you and I not living up to the high standards that God has called us to, not only will we lose out personally, so will the world that is out there, those nations that are dying, longing to see the light of Jesus Christ. Thank you. I will not be able to get to chapter 6, verses 1 through 5. Appreciate you praying for wisdom for me. Blessings. God strengthens or God hardens or toughens, almost like Flintstone. Ezekiel was to be sent to a nation and a people that were hard-hearted, incredibly stubborn, a stiff-necked and rebellious people. And so God hardened, strengthened, and toughened him because God knew who he was going to be going to. Also about his family, we read in the first chapter that his father was a priest named Buzai and probably was from the priestly line of Zadok. We cover that in the books of Samuel. Ezekiel, get this, he was married and he dearly loved his wife. Ezekiel the prophet was married and dearly loved his wife. We'll come across it in a later chapter where God, speaking to Ezekiel, says, I will take away from thee the desire of thine eyes. He loved his wife dearly. Ezekiel the man, he was, listen to this, he was a contemporary of both the prophet Jeremiah and the man of God Daniel. However, Jeremiah was the prophet of God to Israel before Israel was taken captive into Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar and those kings. And Daniel was the man of God at the same time as Ezekiel, except that Daniel was ministering in the palace of the Babylonian kings, while Ezekiel was ministering the word of God to those in exile as an exile himself. Ezekiel was born free under King Josiah, a godly young ruler in Israel. However, he was taken exile when Israel was besieged and Jerusalem fell to Babylon at the young, tender age of about 18 years. And he was then taken as an exile to Babylon, which is modern-day Iraq. His tomb still, well, it will always be in Iraq. As late as 1860, the Jews and Muslims were squabbling over who would have rights and possession over that tomb. His tomb stands in Iraq today. The message of Ezekiel is divided into five main themes, and I want to emphasize the first theme, which is the otherness or the holiness of God. The Hebrew word for holiness is kodesh, meaning to be separate. God's holiness is emphasized. It means holiness means to be separate. Now listen to this statement. The God of Israel did not possess this quality. He is it. He doesn't possess holiness. He is holy. Therefore, those who ministered to God were called holy people, a holy nation. The very garments the priests wore were holy garments. The place was called a holy place. His name was holy. They were a holy nation and they worshipped him upon a holy mountain. That's the first theme of the book. Secondly, the sinfulness of Israel. As a nation, her idolatry, worship of nature and of the created objects, syncretism. We'll come to that later in this lesson. Syncretism was one of their greatest sins. Number three, we see as a result of their ungodliness and idolatry, God's judgment falls upon them. And fourthly, the fourth theme was the individual responsibility that each of the children of Israel had, even when they were in exile, and that the prophet Ezekiel had. He was called a watchman in chapter 3, and you and I are also watchmen. He was to the house of Israel, we are to the world at large. The individual responsibility. And fifthly, the final theme in this book is the promise of future restoration. Everybody here is familiar with chapter 37, the Valley of Dry Bones. But God said, Son of Man, prophesy unto these dry bones that they will live again. And there's the promise and the hope of future restoration from a remnant for the children of Israel, for the nation of Israel. The book of Ezekiel. The style, it's mixed prose and poetry. It has visions, parables, prophetic imagery, symbolism, dramatic action. And Jerome, one of the early respected church fathers, said, Ezekiel, the book of Ezekiel, is an ocean and a labyrinth of the mysteries of God. It's an ocean and a labyrinth of the mysteries of God. Some of the key words, and this is intriguing, the phrase, Son of Man, appears just more than 90 times in this book alone. And the phrase, are you listening? Son of Man appears just less than 90 times in the four Gospels alone. In fact, Son of Man was Jesus Christ's favorite title for himself. The phrase Lord God appears 200 times approximately in this one book alone. And this phrase, the word of the Lord came to me, appears 49 times in the book of Ezekiel itself. That phrase, the word of the Lord came to me, or thus saith the Lord, appears the most in the book of Ezekiel as compared to any other prophet, period. 49 times in 48 chapters, he says, the word of the Lord came to me. In chapter 37, verse 11, again a reference to the Valley of Dry Bones, when you read this phrase in verse 11 of chapter 37, where the children of Israel in despair say, our hope is gone. Our hope is lost. But today, listen, in Israel's national anthem, I quote a stanza from the heart of Israel's national anthem. Ezekiel 37:11, the Jews said, our hope is lost. But when they sing their national anthem, these are the words. Our hope is not yet lost. The hope of 2,000 years to be a free people in our land, the land of Zion and Jerusalem. That's a takeoff from Ezekiel. But today the Jews sing, our hope is not yet lost. The hope of 2,000 years to be a free people in our land, the land of Zion and Jerusalem. Chapter 1. Verses 1 through 3 are the call and commissioning of Ezekiel. And again he begins by saying, the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel. That phrase is the very essence of prophecy. How can we speak forth or foretell what the plan of God is if he hasn't spoken to us first? So that is the very essence of prophecy. And he was in his 30th year. Again, Jesus began when he was 30. 30 was the year in Israel where you were allowed to assume your priestly responsibilities. You were considered to be mature, a man. In his 30th year, Ezekiel, remember, was an exile as a young man from the age of 18. He must have felt frustrated in his priestly calling. He was of a priestly family. Uzziah was a priest. He would have felt frustrated in his priestly calling, his young prime years of his life out here as an exile. Better men would have despaired. But Ezekiel clung on and continued to hope. His hopes could have felt, he could have felt like his hopes were dashed, but he continued to hope. He was standing by the Kibar Canal. There are two great rivers going through Iraq, and that's the river Euphrates and the river Tigris. In fact, it's believed that the Garden of Eden was located between those two rivers. But Ezekiel was not by one of these gorgeous rivers. Because the land is so dry, they had a canal dug, and he was by the Kibar Canal. So in a sense, he was by the Kibar Canal in a dreary wasteland of human experience, dejected, frustrated in his priestly calling, in exile, in despair. But there, God met him. He says, I was by the Kibar Canal. No one had heard of such a place. Yet in that place, at that down point in his life, the hand of God grasped him. That's really what we understand from the Hebrew. And Paul the Apostle says the same thing in the New Testament. We read the word, he was apprehended. There's a song on radio, apprehended by love. Ezekiel was apprehended. He was grasped by God, taken out of the pit of despair, and turned around as he says, I saw the Lord. The challenge I want to give us today, if any one of us here today is at a Kibar Canal experience in our lives, feeling in despair, dejected in a dreary wasteland of human experience, in a boring drudgery, in a treadmill, God can meet you at your Kibar Canal. That's where he met Ezekiel. Verses 4 through 28, the vision itself that he saw. He sees God in the form of a theophany. As he's standing by the Kibar Canal, suddenly he hears and sees these storm clouds thicken and darken, and lightning begins to flash, and as if right then the curtain rolls back, and he sees four living creatures or heavenly beings. They are defined later on in the book as cherubim. And these four cherubim are carrying a majestic chariot-like extraordinary vehicle. And in that vehicle, or this extraordinary chariot, is a glorious being, which is a theophany or a form or a shape that God took on. And when Ezekiel sees this, he falls flat on his face, prostrate on the ground at the presence of God. Folk, John the Revelator had the exact same experience. When he saw the resurrected Christ in a vision on the Isle of Patmos, he fell flat on the ground, unable to move in the presence of God. He fell on his face, prostrate in awe, and suddenly part of the vision now becomes clear. Listen to this. He sees these cherubim, four of them, with this chariot-like, extraordinary chariot, with the glorious living being on it. In the Old Testament, the Ark of the Covenant was referred to as a chariot, and over the mercy seat in the Holy of Holies were two cherubim. God was showing Ezekiel. Ezekiel's such a book, if you read on the surface, you might say, I don't get anything. God, you got to dig deep. God was showing Ezekiel, you are not in your home city of Jerusalem where my temple and my Ark of the Covenant is. But the Ark was called a chariot, and he sees God, as it were, being carried in a chariot. And the cherubim, which were in the mercy seat of the Holy of Holies, he sees the cherubim here. God is showing Ezekiel, you don't have to wait to go back to Jerusalem to find me. Jesus told the woman in John 4:24, God is a spirit. You don't have to wait anymore to go to Jerusalem to worship me. God's a spirit. Those who worship him in spirit and in truth. Anywhere throughout the world, even at the Kiba Canal, God was showing Ezekiel, I am here. Here's the chariot. Here are the cherubim. Here I am. The Lord of heaven and earth can be experienced even at the Kiba Canal. The cherubic faces, these four cherubim, each of them, it says, had four faces, and each face, one of them was of a man, symbolic of intelligence. One was of a lion, symbolic of majesty. And one was of an ox, that of patient strength and service. And the fourth was of an eagle, as swift to see and judge, a creature of the heavens. And they move, Ezekiel said he saw these four cherubim move straight forward. Now, being divine agents, they do not need to deviate from an assigned task. They just go. When they're commissioned by God, they go. Nothing hinders them or can bar their way. And he saw coals of fire, as it were, running up and down these cherubim, which are symbols of holiness and judgment. Recall Isaiah. He was a man of unclean lips, and the coal was placed in his lips, and it cleansed him and his tongue. So the coals are symbolic of judgment, of holiness and of judgment, because the coals of fire will be unleashed in judgment from the judgment of God. And now the phrase, he sees beneath these cherubim wheels and a wheel in the middle of a wheel. The Negro spiritual puts it beautifully when they talk about the wheel in the middle of the wheel. Those folk have caught the spirit of what Ezekiel was really saying. A wheel in the middle of the wheel. First of all, we think that the wheel is an astounding invention. From the moment the wheel was invented, man has gone on and on and progressed so much. But I believe in my spirit, my opinion, that there is such a device. Now remember, we're working with limited human knowledge, and God is God, that he's got a device that is not just one-dimensional, what we think is a three-dimensional wheel, but he's got a device which is wheels in the middle of wheels. And here's a thought. Have you heard of a spirograph? It's one large circle with gear-like teeth on the inside. Then you have smaller, different-shaped circles, and you put your pen or your pencil, and you can make unlimited designs in perfect harmony and perfect unity with the wheel in the middle of a wheel. And Ezekiel is unable to describe it better than saying he saw these wheels as a wheel in the middle of a wheel. It also symbolizes that in addition to the unlimited, unending permutations and combinations in the mind and the wisdom of God, this device of this wheel in the middle of a wheel shows that God can move anywhere, anytime, unhindered, unimpeded. He has power over everyone in every place. Another thought about the wheel in the middle of the wheel shows God had the power to move. It talks about movement. So constructed so as to enable movement in any direction shows God's power to work anywhere. God is alive. He is vibrant. He is on the move. Either we are stuck in a rut or we need to get into the move of God. Then he goes on to say that the rims of the wheels are full of eyes. God is all-seeing, all-knowing. He's the omniscient God. And he talks about the noise of the wings of the cherubim were like a mighty torrent of water, indicative of his unlimited strength and power. That is, nothing can stop God or prevent his plans. And we know from Jeremiah, he says that the plans I have for you are for good and not for evil. And then it says, at a certain point in time, the cherubim let down their wings. That's a sobering and a humbling thought. These four living creatures, these cherubim, who are right in the immediate presence of God, when he says something, they drop their wings. They stand stock still. Even man does not give God that kind of complete, total obedience and submission. Not yet. And they dropped their wings. Their complete attention and obedience is given to God. They were created only to do his bidding, not their own. Then he talks about, he sees a bow or a rainbow, circular. You know, we invariably see half of the rainbow. In reality, in totality, it's full, it's a circle. You see descriptions of artists who have studied this, and when they draw what they think the throne of God is like, it's a complete, unending circular rainbow around the throne of God. And he sees this bow. Now remember, this young man is an exile. in despair, on rationed food, on a starvation diet, made to work hard. And he sees this bull. The rainbow was a sign of hope again, not just to Noah, not just to the exiles with Ezekiel, but to the entire world at large. Here's some cautions about people who, though, tend to run after visions or desire greatly a vision of God or talk about a vision that they had of the Lord or of heaven. Beware of a visionary theology, because even if you did have a vision and it was a genuine vision of heaven or of the Lord, that's not all that God is. That's just a little piece or fragment or particle of God's character or image that you saw. So beware of a visionary theology, but then we hold on to that as the entire revelation of God for us for the rest of our lives. It's just a part. Also, there is no place, as we see in this passage, there is no place where God's presence may be denied. Whatever your Kibar canal may be, God is omnipresent, he is supreme, he is right there. There's no place where the presence of God may be denied. And who understood that better again than Paul the Apostle, when after being smacked on his face in the dust and the dirt on the road to Damascus, later on he wrote, "What can separate us from the love of Christ? No height, no width, no breadth, no depth, no powers, past, present, things to come. Nothing can separate us from the love of Christ." Chapter 2. Verses 1 through 7 deal with Ezekiel's call. He is grasped by the Spirit. First of all, at the end of chapter 1, he's left flat on his face. Folk, if you ever have a vision of the Lord, I believe with all of my heart, we'll never be able to be left standing on our feet. Just like John, just like Ezekiel. In John's case, that almost makes me cry, because he is down on his face, and Jesus bends down, stoops, and touches him to infuse the strength of God into his physical human frame to give him enough energy to stand up. In this case, it's not Jesus touching him, but it says the Spirit of God set him on his feet. He couldn't get up. And so we find at the beginning of chapter 2, Ezekiel is grasped by the Spirit of God, set on his feet, and he says again, "Son of Man," again emphasizes in this case the humanness of Ezekiel. There are absolutely no messianic overtones in this reference of Son of Man to Ezekiel. And this is the beginning of the call on any human being's life, when immortal God addresses mortal man. Son of Man, here's what I'm calling you to do. That's the beginning of a genuine call of God in a person's life. Notice a couple of things about this. One, about the call. Notice the divine approach. If there's somebody with a quote-unquote call in their life, it is God who does the calling. God calls, and when God calls, he equips, he empowers, and he sends. The only supposed exception is Isaiah. Now beware of this, because many people come up and say, "God called me to do this, God called me to do that, and God told me to do this." And they will quote Isaiah, where Isaiah said, "Here am I, Lord, send me." That is the only, are you listening? That is the only time in the entire Bible talking about disciples, apostles, and prophets, all combined, where any man said, "Here am I, send me." In every single other case, God said, "Son of Man, you're going to do this." So just in case people overplay and say, "Well, God said I need to do this, God called me," beware, because if God really called someone, you'll find out about it, they won't have to tell you. Isaiah was the exception and not the rule. Somebody said, well, the second thought about this, about the call, there's an injunction to Ezekiel where God says to him, "And don't be afraid." Right there, it's almost a guarantee to Ezekiel that he is going to be rebuffed by his people. They were an extremely rebellious nation. And God's warning him, "Don't be afraid." And how would you like to have that as part of your call? Because you know that you're going to be rebuffed, you're going to be hurt, you're going to be rejected by your own people. It's a guarantee. Somebody said, and I'm sure some of you will remember this phrase, they used to say to advertise for the Navy, "Join the Navy, see the world." And if it were a call for a prophet, they would have had to say, because this is what God tells him, "Join the prophets, be called, be cast on prickles and thorns and sit on scorpions." And who'd want to be a prophet then? And God's warning him, but don't be afraid. Listen to this thought about being a prophet. One is not enticed to prophethood, but compelled. When God calls you, it's like a fire in your bones, as Jeremiah said. You're compelled to do it. You're compelled to be it. You can't be anything else. One is not enticed to prophethood. One is compelled. By the way, as far as joining the Navy, my mother told me this years ago. She said, I joined the Navy to see the world, but what did I see? I saw the sea. That's just from the 40s. No, I had to be in the 50s. I wasn't born in the 40s. On to chapter 2, verse 8, through chapter 3, verse 3, the eating of the scroll. This was somewhat like a strange ordination service for Ezekiel. There were no fellow ministers or fellow priests or relatives and family around. It was just him and God at the Kibar Canal. And he is given the scroll and he is asked to eat the scroll. The first thing he's asked to do is an act of obedience. Who was he being sent to? A rebellious generation, a disobedient people, and God's wanting to separate him from the people. If you are truly to be my prophet, you must obey my command. Now eat the scroll. And the scroll was basically a long strip of papyrus wrapped around a central spindle. This scroll was unusual because it had writing on both the sides with words of woe and lamentation. One scholar says there was so much of the wrath of God to be poured out that he had to squeeze it on both sides of the same scroll. Just a thought. Now, notice some things here. Ezekiel, I mentioned, was a prophet to be sent to a rebellious generation. And the first thing he was asked to do was obey. That act, because he did eat the scroll, distinguished himself from the people. And because of his act of obedience, are you listening? He finds the scroll to taste as sweet as honey. Because of his act of obedience, the scroll then tastes as sweet as honey, even though the words it contains are condemnation, judgment, and the wrath of God, because it's going to be very bitter to the people. But it's sweet to an obedient person. Here's a beautiful thought on obedience. There is, in all acts of obedience, a sweet taste. There is, in all acts of obedience, a sweet taste. When you obeyed what you know God showed you in your spirit, you know how you feel that night when you put your head in your pillow? A sense of fulfillment, a deep peace of God. There is, in all acts of obedience, a sweet taste. Psalm 34:8, David caught the thought and he said, "Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good." Secondly, a second thought on this, about the scroll, eating of the scroll, what food was to a physical body, the scroll was to Ezekiel's ministry. He needed the word of the Lord in him in order to be able to impart in his prophetic ministry to the people. Any ministry requires strength and sustenance. Chapter 3, we continue verses 4 through 15, his commissioning. Suddenly, we find that Ezekiel's name takes on much significance. He has sent an incredibly stubborn people. And in here, in some versions, we have the phrase, God says, "I'm going to make you adamant." Literally in Hebrew, one version translates that as diamond. I'm going to make you like diamond. If you are going to a stiff-necked people with a heart of stone, what cuts stone? A diamond point cuts stone. Son of man, I'll make you adamant, like the point of a diamond, to etch into their hearts of stone what I must say. And you see the significance of his name, Ezekiel. God strengthens, toughens, hardens. Verse 10, God continues to tell Ezekiel, here's a caution to him, "All my words that I speak, receive with thine heart and hear with thine ears." In other words, Ezekiel, just because you ate the scroll doesn't mean you have the entire word of the Lord to you. You need to keep on listening. In fact, as Christians, we are to perpetually be tuned in to listen to the voice of God. And to the prophet, he says, you need to keep on listening to all my ears. Receive them in your heart and hear with your ears. Verse 14, the vision is over. And suddenly, Ezekiel opens his eyes and sees he's standing where? By the Kibar Canal. Or was it here? He's transported to Tel Aviv. That's the village where he lived. And the word they use is bitterness. Ezekiel says, "I was bitter in my spirit. There was bitterness within me." Why? It's such an anticlimactic experience. From being right in the, experiencing the presence and the glory of the God of Israel, suddenly he's in the village of Tel Aviv with his fellow exiles, And he is totally dejected. Bitterness takes over his soul. Here's an interesting thought. The town Tel Abib literally means a heap left by the flood. And so from this beautiful experience of God, he's now in a heap, in a what we would call in America a dump. He's back to his dump, and this bitterness, why did I have to come back here? And secondly, it's not an easy thing. True, they are a stiff-necked, rebellious people, but they are the only companions he has. They are his family, his friends. And he is to now pronounce terrible words of the wrath of God and the judgment of God to them. And there's a bitter feeling in his heart. To be called a prophet means to come down from the mountain. Ezekiel didn't want to come down. He was bitter about it. Can you remember another man of God, another prophet? Moses. To be called a prophet means to come down from the mountain. You'll have those mountaintop experiences, but even though he had to veil his face, Moses had to come down to the people with the word of the Lord. Verses 14 and 15, we read where Ezekiel says, "And the Spirit lifted me up and took me away." The proper term for that, folk, is teleportation. How I wish we had that in this day and age. We're going to Korea September 24th. I'd love to be teleported there. Just flying 15 hours nonstop is not funny at all. Teleportation is just, think about it, zap. There you are, right there. I sense that man will not reach that before Jesus comes. But this is what happened to Ezekiel. It also happened to Philip. He was teleported to the Ethiopian eunuch, whisked away by the Spirit of God and put right there. So that's what happened to Ezekiel too. Chapter 3, verses 16 through 21, and here is where God calls Ezekiel a watchman. When he is teleported to Tel Abib, he is in such a state of shock and with sudden bitterness, he sits there for 7 whole days in complete utter shock, awe, and silence. And at the end of the 7th day, again he hears, "Son of man!" And that's reassuring to him because it affirms to him, confirms to him, that what he experienced a week back was not a hallucination or a delusion, but it was real, because again the same voice of God wakes him out of the stupor of the 7 days and says, "Son of man." So he knows God is still talking with him, and that was a real experience. He says here, "The word of God came to me," and he is called a watchman. Now here's some very sobering thoughts about him being called a watchman and us being watchmen to our generation. Number one, to be a watchman involves a great responsibility. A sentinel or a guard, his responsibility is to spot the enemy coming from afar off and to warn his camp. If he doesn't, there will be a great slaughter of his camp, and if he escapes with his own life, he will bear the terrible guilt of not having warned his people. In other words, as God tells Ezekiel, "I will require their blood at your hand, son of man." So if you aspire to be a prophet, imagine the much greater responsibility we have. "I will require," God himself tells Ezekiel, "if you do not warn him, I will require..."